Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Carson. Pinstar.
Just let me know when we're going to start and I'll do the intro.
Can we hum the theme?
No.
That's Jeopardy, I think.
It is.
This is a Polycast episode 113. We are joined today by our guest co-hosts, Gil Cawson.
Hey, over here.
Pin Star.
Beware of the all-seeing raccoon.
Philip Alou.
Pursuit of AI and happiness is our constitutional right.
And Quick.
Rain or shine, play Civ.
And me, Lisa. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Howdy.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it's worth noting that, Pinstar, you are going to be setting a bit of a record here in the sense that you are our first-time guest since we have switched over to the live format.
Oh, crud.
How does it feel?
Good.
So you're the first guest on the show that's not able to draw on the experience of when we used to pre-record the show.
Oh, the things that went on.
Well, you have listened to us, right?
Oh, absolutely. Hang on one sec. I just got to drop my difficulty, maybe Settler or something. Is there a Settler difficulty for podcasting?
I can do one better than that. There's actually pre-Settler.
Yes, Dan is the master of pre-Settler. I never could attain that skill.
We're going to be starting here talking about the patch, but only very briefly, seeing as how, I don't know, we extensively talked about the patch before release last time. And 2K and Firaxis, I'd like to give you the 50 culture points, but I've mentioned about releasing the patch on the 27th to the 28th of February. Not the 1st of March, but hey, you had to give it that extra day. By all means, it's just now the March patch. So seeing as how that was only released a few days ago, decided that we're not going to really get into what is the patch like to actually play now, give some people some experience with the patch post-release, myself included. And we will follow up on the next episode with some single-player experiences, multiplayer experiences, and the like. One thing that actually came up that I will note with regards to the patch release, however, is this is only for the PC version of Civilization V. If you have the Mac version, you will have to wait for Aspyr Media, which did the Mac port, to have the same patch changes applied to the Mac version. Of course, this doesn't apply if you're using Parallels or something, because you got the PC version and you're using it on Mac. But anyway, if you have the Mac version, you're still at whatever the previous patch release is. The other big news in the Civ community this week is the release of the Polynesia Scenario Pack. It is the latest Civilization V downloadable content for €2.99 or $4.99. There was a walkthrough posted by the associate manager the associate marketing manager at Firaxis, Civ V's publisher, Pete Murray, describing the civilization. So we are going to now listen to just a portion of what he had to say. We're going to describe the civilization first, and then we shall discuss.
Meet Kamehameha, leader of the Polynesians. In Civilization V, each civ has a unique ability, and the Polynesian ability is called wayfinding. Their units can embark and move over oceans right from the beginning of the game, and they can see an extra hex while embarked. This means that the Polynesians can spread rapidly across the world right from the start of the game. Polynesia near the beginning of the game, a time when this civ really shines. The Maori warrior here can terrorize nearby enemy units, reducing their strength. It's a little like having a great general with each unit, but instead of making your units stronger, makes your opponent's units weaker. The Polynesians can also construct the Moai tile improvement. It'll give your city a culture boost if you work that tile, but it has another cool ability. It makes your nearby units stronger in combat. If you choose to play as this civ, you'll be able to explore the world faster than your opponents, grabbing up ruins and easily setting your valuable coastal resources. That should give you enough of an edge early on that your opponents will be forced to play catch-up for the rest of history.
All right, so there's the introduction again from Pete Murray to the Polynesian civilization. So just to be kind of reiterate some of that, the leader is...
Kamei! Oh, sorry.
You beat me to the Dragon Ball joke.
Well, to be fair, he kind of sort of did predate Dragon Ball, but, you know, our minds have just been poisoned to that extent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's no recovering from that.
Afraid not. Right now, I'm just already, I feel my facial features just stretching into, like, craziness.
I haven't looked at a screenshot. Is his hair, like, bright yellow?
Only when he's really angry.
Yes.
No, but there's a couple things that strike me as interesting about this civilization. One of them is just if you're playing on a map where it matters, the unique ability of finding civs earlier, that's kind of scary. A lot of earlier contacts can be abused in this game. The Maori warrior, I haven't really used it yet, so I'm not sure to what extent that it's going to be too strong or, you know, just about right or whatever. But it looks like it's a pretty solid thing to have, especially because it's early in the game and like so many other uniques.
Not to mention you can also find other city-states earlier in the game, especially coastal ones, so you can have your pick and choice of which ones you want to befriend early on if you have a burst of gold. Not to mention you'll be snapping up all those gold bonuses. Probably most of them will be 30 gold instead of the 15, since you're probably going to be the first one getting to them.
That's right. If it's maritime and you want maritime, you can find one if it's on the map. That's a very good point.
Yeah, so the embarking and moving over oceans immediately on maybe anything except, you know, like a Pangaea, or maybe even if you wanted to go a little crazy on Pangaea, that immediately strikes me as, wow, almost any game you're thinking about in Civ 5, there's an immediate benefit there. There's also plus one sight when embarked, which can help with some... early, say, barbarian, I want to say galley, trireme concerns, although I guess both. And then there's also this plus 10% combat strength within two tiles of a Moai statue, which I guess I don't have an immediate comment on that, just because I don't think really the Moai statue was described in that walkthrough from Pete. So this is a unique building, or is this, yeah, I think it's a unique building, right?
He made it sound like it was a tile improvement, though.
Yeah. Was it that, or was it a tile improvement that then the Polynesian workers could build? I'm not sure. But it sounds neat. I guess we won't have the Maui statue's national wonder like we did in Civ 4. Oh, well.
Yeah.
I'll live without my plus one hammers on water tiles, I guess.
Those would be great in Civ 5, though.
Oh, man, that'd be absolutely disgusting.
Yes.
Never quite understood how you extracted production from the sea with the aid of magical statues.
You see some very interesting theories on the Civ Fanatics forums, but I had no idea either how that might be done.
The power of the tide.
The pyramids also let you have any government civic.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, some of the suggestions about why certain wonders have the effects that they do, national or... World Wonders in Civ 4, Civ 5. I bet you could go back and do the same for Civ 1 through Civ 3. I think some of these people should consider writing a book, writing for a television show or a movie script or something, because the creativity is impressive at times. And it can also be ridiculous. Well, it can also be ridiculously impressive, but in any event. there's also the Polynesian scenario that you get along with the civilization itself. And actually, before we get to that, I think it's worthwhile to note that unlike the previous DLC Civ Babylonia, this works, at least reportedly, is to work in both single player as well as multiplayer. There have been some multiplayer issues that I've seen already, but perhaps we'll follow up that on the next episode once some more people get a chance to try this and play this out. But I have not played a Civilization scenario in, my gosh, since Civilization 2. None of them particularly intrigued me, and I don't know if I can quite put my finger on why this scenario intrigues me, but it is. And I'll turn it back over to Pete to describe.
Paradise Found. The goal of this scenario is to be the first of four Polynesian cultures to complete all of the scenario's social policies and become the dominant culture of Polynesia. This scenario has special technology and social policy trees, and each of the four cultures can gain access to the Maori warrior and Moai. There's another special rule for this scenario. The cost of social policies doesn't increase as you add more cities to your civilization. If you've tried to win a culture victory under the original Civ 5 rules, you know that too many cities can drag on your culture. Here, you can spread out across the Pacific as much as you would like and still push hard on culture. We've included a special South Pacific map based on the geography of that part of the world, or you can play this scenario on a random archipelago map and have a new experience each time you start the game.
The fact that you can expand and not have to worry about investing in all of the cultural infrastructure in order to keep the culture output going towards more social policies, but also being able to disembark right away, those two things combined, and also knowing the type of map that you're going to be playing, just seems to change things up sufficiently to intrigue me. And if that wasn't enough, as I said, the social policy tree itself is different.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit weird to me. I mean, does that mean that you have different social policies, or they just do different things, or...?
Yes.
Okay.
An article that has some screenshots, and this was posted prior to the expansion pack being released, and it shows just a very brief snapshot of those social policies. And no, I can't remember any of the specifics, but let's just say a picture is worth 1,000 words, so yeah, go ahead and look at those. It would also benefit, I think, once we've had a chance to play. And I'm actually looking forward to see if this actually works in multiplayer. So, you know, I'm going to be suggesting whenever games tonight that we have this really heavy base water map and only I can play Polynesian. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't work in multiplayer that well, though, right? Or
something. And then everybody dogpiled Dan.
Yeah. There's that alliteration going for what you just said, so I like it in that sense, but every other way, I don't know about that. I guess there was also a freebie that was released that was included in the description. I don't think it was on Eurogamer. It was from some other site that I'm going to fail to give credit to. Three new multiplayer maps, which is Skirmish, a small map created especially for intense one-on-one duels of Civ. Ring, where you'll face enemies on your flanks and have a chance to sail across the middle of the world to fight your opponents, quote unquote. And Ancient Lake, set around an inland sea, the heart of which hides a secret. I hope that's Eldorado.
You mean Skill Dorado.
I was trying not to editorialize quite this early in the show, but these maps are carefully balanced for competitive online play and will give players new worlds to conquer, quote-unquote. So it sounds like that these are not available in single player then. I don't know exactly how that works, but seeing as how it's marketed as a multiplayer pack, these are actually available for only multiplayer right now. That's okay, because there's a lot of single-player maps that are not available for multiplayer. So, there. But you will note that if you go to Steam's listing for Civilization V, they list Polynesia, but they don't list that you can acquire these multiplayer maps for free. I wonder what's up with that.
They just don't want you to know.
I guess that's what it is. Thanks, Steam. I'm really angry now. In fact, you could say I'm steamed.
Oh, God. I don't know.
I'm sure we will revisit how broken they are at a future time once we all have more experience with them.
That guy sounds like such a fan. Like that guy on the Polynesia post. Polynesia is here. And then he's like, very nice notification within the game menu. Wow, this Civ is awesome. I love the Hawaiian music. Woohoo! Like, he's so excited. I mean, we're all, I don't know, we're all geeks here, but he might take it to the extreme.
He probably got hired at the
guy for your marketing. That's just how it is.
I don't know. I kind of like his enthusiasm. You want to curb it?
It sounds like he was a travel agent that was just hired to do video games. Like, oh, I'm not promoting, like, vacations to Polynesia. Oh, I'm actually promoting Polynesia. All right, well, I'll do it in the same style. Come visit lovely Polynesia. See the beaches.
I like the thread on a poll that said that, hey, there's a Civ named after us now. Well, that looks like someone's taking you up on your trip offer there, Pinstar. They're going to
play right now.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
What are you apologizing for there? I think Pinstar's happy. You just gave him a commission.
Yeah, there you go. Get a little kickback.
What would you get, like 50 culture points? 75 culture points to apply to your next game? Guilt-free?
Yeah, exactly. Mercenary.
Whoa, mercenary. What's this now?
Kidding.
Or are you? Looking at a number of topics here under Research Lab, and we have not had a Research Lab, any Research Lab topics at all so far, so why don't we start with unhappiness?
This thread was posted by CGG1066. Basically, what they were proposing was the fact that right now in Civ 5, the only two happiness, or rather unhappiness, thresholds that people worry about is at 0 happiness or 10 happiness. 0 being when all the cities start slowing way down in terms of population growth, and 10 happiness, or rather negative 10 happiness, being when the military starts taking penalties to their combat abilities due to unhappiness. He or she is proposing that, just dodging around those two thresholds is not quite as dynamic and realistic. And they are making suggestions of, for each individual point of unhappiness, to cause unemployment within your cities, basically rendering a small portion of your production or workforce useless, a la the way an unhappy citizen was useless in Civ 4. And then as your negative happiness grew larger and larger, people would start rebelling and breaking off, and these would actually appear around local cities, so there would be actually a local component to the unhappiness that you'd find in any of the given cities. And then at 51%, the city goes into disorder, a la even earlier Civs. And after five turns, it breaks away, and either if it was a puppet or annex city, would return to the previous owner. Otherwise, it becomes a whole new Civ. Which didn't that happen in like what Civ 2 or 3? That's just when a new Civ would come out there. The only thing is, your capital would never revolt, no matter how unhappy the people were. So that's pretty much the pursuit of unhappiness.
I like how that this person, who was this person?
CGG1066.
Yes, I don't know why I didn't remember that.
It just rolls right off the tongue.
I like his point about how we've got this, that there's this point of, where you're at, essentially like 1 unhappiness to 9 unhappiness. You're kind of watching things, but you're not really necessarily doing anything actively about it. I mean, maybe you are, but it's just kind of a passive thing. There isn't some sort of threshold in this big range in terms of bad things that are happening to you. So I like the idea that there is, whatever the specific happens to be, that there's some particular point, something that could be consistently applied game to game, that's going to happen when you're at maybe two, 4, 6, 8 unhappiness, rather than have something at like 1 through 9. He says that, that the numbers are gut feelings of what would work. Even if and when this idea was implemented, they would probably need adjusting. This 2% rule about citizens going to like unemployment, I think that's 2% of the population for every city, right? Given that happiness is a Civ-wide mechanic right now?
That seems that way. Although it'd be kind of weird, because with 2% of the population going into unemployment, conceivably 2% of whatever they're producing is going to be nullified. But I mean, depending on how you round, I mean, it's pretty much going to be 1 lost item, or 0, depending on whether or not it rounds up or down. So in which case, people would just play the rounding rather than the threshold of that, of the 0 or 10.
Yes, and Civ 5 production is pretty low in general, so I would imagine if you didn't round up, you wouldn't see very much negative effect. And I like the idea that you get something kind of a sliding scale as you go into more unhappiness, as opposed to just hard thresholds. I don't think production is the right thing to attack. I don't know, maybe maintenance or something else. But, you know, production's bad enough in Civ 5 as it is already. And you can even read between the lines in the recent patch and see that they're doing more to bring production to the game earlier and add more production to the game, essentially. And this would be a step in the wrong direction in that light.
I do like the idea of getting harsher and harsher penalties as you grow deeper and deeper into the negatives. I mean, if you're not at war and you're not trying to grow your cities, you know, there's no real incentive to, you know, there's no real harsh penalty to being at below negative 10. So you could just keep diving lower and lower into the unhappiness. But if things start, you know, breaking off and cities going into, you know, into rebellion at low enough, you might actually care about keeping your unhappiness in check, which might help combat some ICS strategies.
I mean, to me, the big ICS combative strategy now is when you get to the 10 unhappy, all of a sudden, it's minus 33, it's boom. Maybe what we could have, I know in the thread the question came up of whether the combat penalty was the right way to go, in part because perhaps it's just targeting ICS people, but that's a big portion of the community, and yeah, I put myself under that bracket and through warfare and all that kind of thing. Perhaps rather than instantly at 10 unhappiness, minus 33%, it's at 2, 4, 6, 8, you've got some other incremental negative percentage for combat. So it's kind of, okay, it's not all of a sudden a big whammy, and it's all of a sudden this big threshold, like all of a sudden you drop off the face of the earth, like minus 33% out of the blue, whoa. Perhaps even to help some newer players as well, if they're not really paying attention to that, then all of a sudden they're hit with this unhappiness, unless they can be trading for some resources. If they're having to build happiness buildings, then with the production hit as well, trying to get out of that, sort of having to go back and reload an older save to do that again. Perhaps it'll give them a little bit of a wake-up call that, hey, it's not really bad, but, you know, it's not good. And now it's bad. And now it's getting worse. And now, holy crap, look what you have done.
Okay.
Like a 5-point scale of, oh, crap.
The oh, crap-o-meter.
Perhaps now we will go on to something that is related to happiness, in the sense that happiness is in the game in Civilization 5, just like it was in Civilization 4, but this following concept got removed in Civilization 5.
That would be health. Yes, there's a thread on Civ Fanatics by Aussie Lurker, and he has titled it Ideas for Bringing Back Health. And he says, look, I get the reason they decided to take health out, but he still reckons it's unacceptable. And he goes on to present, much like you would in any other research lab topic, some suggestions for changing it. And it's a little long, but essentially what he's saying is that he wants to see a global and local level for both happiness and health, as well as penalties for having unhappiness and unhealth. So, for example, at the local level, happiness surplus could give a boost to hammer and culture output, as well as plus 5, contributing to the global pool. And then at the global level, Golden Ages, distance modifier to building maintenance, cut by 10%, improved rate of assimilation of foreign tiles and cities, just as an example. And he's got, like, Golden Ages again and such. And then for unhappiness, maybe a local unhappiness thing would be happiness deficit will have the opposite effect to happiness surplus, impacting culture and production down to a maximum of, say, negative 5. Again, I don't know if I like that, but okay. And then at the global level, distance modifier increased. So, you know, basically the opposite effects in each case. And then over to health, similar concept here. Health bonus will give bonus food and gold output. And and then it will take away if it's unhealth at the local level. And then looking at the global level, he is suggesting a modifier for building maintenance. Okay, so it's also... He's pretty much tying it into maintenance consistently here, and I think as a suggestion, you can play with what the effects are for happiness and health. Maybe have them impact different things than maintenance for cities as they get distance or whatever, or maybe have it affect something other than production. Just take your pick. But conceptually, it would be interesting to have a local consideration again. That was an important part of city planning for a long time in Civilization. And to bring back an element of that would add some depth to the game in terms of strategy.
An interesting other way you could take it is, you know, just as with, you know, excess happiness, you get enough of that, you get a golden age. If you had, you know, global healthiness and you had excess of that enough, you could trigger the health version of that, maybe like a baby boom, and then have like all of your cities grow like crazy for like a turn or two, sort of like the pop boom back in Alpha Centauri.
I was initially going to ask who wanted to start into this, but that's already happened, so I could have said that, and I said it anyway. I kind of like the juxtaposition of this thread and the other one, where the one that we looked at last, again, was just looking at unhappiness, period. And I like the concept of bringing health back into it. And I also like how, in some respects, when I'm looking at the local level, there's a particular bonus or penalty based on some particular aspect in the game, and there isn't that overlap there. The only thing that I would change as far as the local level part go was maybe just for the sake of realism, if nothing else, have happiness affect gold and culture, while health affects food and hammer output. As far as this discussion about the global effects, though, I mean, as he noted in the thread and Felon is summarizing, for example, the happiness effect, you know, with the boost to the output of a city to a maximum of, say, +5, as well as contributing to the global pool. Why not just have the global effects be the cumulative effects of local effects? And some of these other things that we get into in terms of these tiers of the global effects, which I think even if you consolidated it down to one tier, some of this could come about, I mean, some of the things, either good or bad, you could maybe be working within the social policy mechanics, or maybe not. I think it's just getting a little too complicated to have these separate tiers, and again, just have it that you've got the local and the global effects, but the global effects are the cumulative local effects. We do need to give the person some benefit who started this thread, because this thread was started just as... actually just before Civilization V itself was released. But at the same time, I think there's some the benefit here, but the strength lies in the local level inputs, and then that affecting things on a global level is a better way to balance the happiness and health combination. Versus five.
It always felt like I was cheating when I built factories and you know plus for this production plus this to percentage of production and no downsides, and I'm like, this is the first Civ where I could build a factory and there is no downside aside from the gold maintenance, but you get that with every improvement building. So you know, yeah, I part of me is I'm definitely agreeing that, you know, we need health in some way or another.
I mean, if you're not healthy, how can you be happy? Really, I mean,
hey, there you go.
I cannot believe I'm actually going to reference this show, perhaps at my peril. But a cartoon that I would watch occasionally when I was a teenager, you know, like Captain Planet and the Planeteers, and there'd be these villains. Stay with me. There'd be these villains that talked about, you know, polluting, and making all of this money. And then as was pointed out, well, what good is all of this money that you're making and all this power that you have? If not only other people's health affected, but your health is affected as well. So then all that time and money you spent putting into that, you can now just turn around and pay your medical expenses, and what kind of quality of life do you have? So in your empire, if you're not managing your health, and we've already seen, for instance, in the latest patch, the addition of the aqueduct, for instance, as a new health building. So, the aqueduct, what was the aqueduct's direct effects again? I'm forgetting already. +2... food, right?
+2 food and 40% of the food required for the next citizen is retained after the city grows, a la the granaries of Civs in the past.
Yeah, there you go. So we already have, it reflected in those buildings itself, a foundation for tying into health. I mean, right now, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, the additional food is kind of indirectly referencing health. I mean, if you've got a granary and an aqueduct, you're increasing the food quality, you know, as far as realism, you're increasing the food quality and the quantity. Therefore, you're able to feed the existing population, which would then make people happier, which would then lead to the birth of new citizens. You notice I'm glossing over some details here on purpose. And that way, happiness and health are tied together, which, by the way, also has alliteration going, in case you hadn't noticed yet.
It's always been weird, that, especially with the new hospital, the plus, you know, you get 5 food from a hospital, and that always has not quite settled with me properly when you visualize it.
Soylent Green.
Either that or a modest proposal.
And so then that takes us to something else that did not make it, well, from one of Civilization IV's expansions anyway, that did not make it into Civilization V, and that is espionage. Ooh, I volunteered myself to introduce this topic, that's right. Okay. So this this thread was started by At Work, which after the username My Wife Hates Civ, I kind of like At. So in this proposed system, there will be 2 different forms of espionage available to the player. Espionage Operations, a system based on options provided to the player, accessed by simply clicking on a city and then choosing the Conduct Espionage option. 2, Get Information Gathering, a passive system based on investment of money, operates similar to bribing of city-states. The extent of information available to the player is based on the size of the investment, which deteriorates over time. There are 3 levels of investment available to the player. Espionage would become available to the player once they research writing, but information gathering would not become available until, by the powers of banking and printing press combined, yes, you are able to you're able to research an entirely new technology called Real Politics, and that's politics with a K, not a C. Make note. And finally, espionage operations and information gathering features will increase in future eras. However, the cost is always dependent on the era and infrastructure of the target civilization, offset by infrastructure built by the player, quote-unquote. So you have not only the ability to increase your ability to spy on your neighbors, but you also have the defensive mechanisms through buildings, for example, that are detailed in the system. And by era, he uses the example that if you are in a more modern era and the civilization was in a farther behind era, it would be easier for you proportionately, even if they have those defenses in place, to be successful in your espionage mission, and then vice versa if you were that much farther behind technologically, as defined by era. But in this system, there would be no need for an actual spy unit, unlike in Civilization IV, for the active missions, as opposed to the passive ones, which, yes, you are gaining passively, but then you still need the PI unit. I'm thinking about lunch. You still need the spy unit in order to be able to actually execute those. And other than perhaps, I was kind of criticized a little bit in the thread with regards to these the 3 tiers, I'm liking this idea, and I'm only saying I dislike the 3 levels just in terms of some of the specifics that were mentioned, not that the fact that there are 3 levels, because I think it's interesting, for instance, for a lot of the game, especially if you are, you know, you're like me, you like starting out at the beginning of the game, you don't necessarily progress to the later ages, that really it's espionage operations are going to be the primary focus of espionage in the game. This information gathering, based on where he says it becomes available, again, would be something that would come a little later. And the fact that that's the passive system that comes later, as opposed to the espionage operations, which is something that's a bit more active on the part of the player. You know, for those people who kind of said, well, you know, espionage, take it or leave it, here's a bit of an incentive to actually take it.
Real question will be whether or not you can steal technologies, because it'll be a return of the way to actually acquire a specific tech from another civ in the game, since trading techs is not a part of that.
He seems to imply later in the thread that you can. Now, Majin pointed out earlier that this is not Civ 4 when we were discussing the unhealth, and I agree that it isn't. And that suggestion didn't smack of Civ 4 too much. It had some changes in it, and it had a global as well as a local component that didn't bother me as much. But any time I see espionage in a Civ game, it bothers me. It's never been implemented in a balanced fashion, as far as I know, not even once. Or, like, you know, maybe it was kind of okay in the older ones because so many other things were also not balanced. I don't know. But in Civilization IV, they never really got it right. So, and including a huge model like this into a game that still needs a lot of work on its fundamental level, I'm a little bit leery to support anything like that from a research lab standpoint, until way in the future when something like this could actually be implemented into the game without breaking it further, I should say. It's the ability to steal text in a game where you can't even trade them is an entirely new dynamic. It scares me that you think of the nightmare it would be to balance these things.
Well, as far as getting to, I'm not sure about some of the specifics that the individual has mentioned. And I was treating my favoritism of this in a vacuum, in the sense that not taking into account some of the other outstanding issues that are far more pressing before we introduce a system like this. But I like what's been proposed in terms of the shell, because I think it's at least starting to address some of the issues that we had with espionage in earlier games, particularly in Civilization 4, while at the same time giving people that option. I think it's, you know, it could also be set up so that, you know, in custom game settings like Civ 4, you could just disable the darn thing altogether. But I do like the idea of it actually, you know, being an option in the game, and I think this template has, you know, is sharing some of the good things that we saw in Civ 4 that maybe weren't executed the best in terms of approach, and leaving room to, you know, tinker with some particulars.
Just got to point out, though, it's got to be considered for Civ 5 not correcting what was wrong about it in Civ 4, which is a sufficiently different model where issues that cropped up in Civ 4 that you wouldn't even think about with espionage either would be exacerbated in Civ 5 or be non-issue in Civ 5 or whatever. When you're designing a new model like that into a new game, you really have to look at the new game and the new model in isolation and how they'll mesh. But yeah, it's a good idea, and it's something that it could eventually become a nice aspect of gameplay. It just seems like that's so far away right now.
I think we're actually agreeing on two sides of the same coin towards the fact that I don't think we're quite ready to talk about specifics yet. And part of that's because of the other issues that need to be addressed. So if we start getting into specifics right now, then we're probably just, you know, one step forward, two steps back, having to revisit it after if and when some issues outside of ICS, like the multiplayer, big multiplayer patch that's been promised, alluded to at some point in the future comes about. And I guess Colonel Mustard also asked, does this come with better demographics, information, and graphics? I don't know about graphics. I mean, I guess, the screen that you would access for espionage would be similar to the interfaces that we have already. Better information, I'm not sure what type of better information you're getting at specifically, I could try to infer. As far as better demographics, it would, you know, actually one thing that I do miss, and when we look at demographics now in Civ 5, you've got the extremes. You've got where you are, and you've also got the best and the worst. Perhaps maybe as a specific that I think might be safe to say is the ability for the demographics for civilizations that you have met. If they don't fall under either the worst or the best, then maybe, I don't know if you know their number necessarily in terms of, okay, like their first, their second, their third. But depending upon it, you could know that, hey, they have these many soldiers, but they're not the best or the worst. And of course, they're not you.
Maybe put it in context of yourself, like, you know, military better than yours, economy worse than yours.
Maybe that could start maybe as kind of like an information gathering. Maybe that's a first tier. And then if you invest in further, you can actually get into some hard numbers. I think with this thread, and I think this person is trying to get at, you know, how could we implement espionage within Civilization 5, just like the consideration of reintroducing health within the context of Civilization 5. And I like that they're both that way, not in terms of, at least strictly speaking, copy and paste from Civ 4 into Civ 5, or even saying, okay, how do we put happiness into a Civilization 6, or put espionage into a Civilization 6? Because there are some threads like that already talking about Civilization 6. So Lisa, something to do with philosophers, which is too bad Mackie isn't here. I wanted her to say philosopher.
Why?
That's a really old reference to a blooper, ladies and gentlemen. Really, really old. Go back to season one bloopers for context. But not right now. Lisa's about to talk.
Well, this topic by C.S. Ferris on Civ Fanatics is talking about his idea of having Greek philosophers in Civ 5. So he says that Greek philosophers should focus on happiness, or they could be able to make a building that increases the nation's happiness or stop unhappiness in an annexed city. So yeah, you know, they could also make a document like Hammurabi's Code, the Magna Carta, and the Constitution. I don't know if I agree with his examples. I don't know if like Hammurabi's, well, I don't know if like the Magna Carta is like a philosophical work, and I also don't know if philosophers increase happiness. Like, do they really increase happiness? Like, couldn't they actually make you sadder? Like, what if the philosopher was Nietzsche or Rand? You know? I don't know.
I think maybe a philosopher should contribute to your nation's confusion metric. You should introduce that. You know, it's kind of like, you know, great philosophers. Like, did you ever notice that you drive on a parkway and park in a driveway? Whoa!
Oh, man.
No way, man.
Ooh. No way!
Trippy.
I was suggested in the course of the discussion about trying to distinguish between great artist and great philosopher benefits. So having great artists be all about the happiness, but have great philosophers contribute towards a rushing a social policy. I think that's important, rushing a social policy, not necessarily Instagram a social philosophy.
Social philosophy, very nice.
Yes. Social philosophy, which is like a social policy, except you say philosophy instead of policy.
And like things don't actually get done; they're just theorized. Because that's the difference, you see.
And then it was there's also the question about, well, what exactly would that the happiness be, or what would, you know, what would it actually contribute in terms of, you know, towards social policy acquisition, for example. And I don't know, if you had it be like an absolute number increase, then that would be more beneficial to you earlier on, as opposed to, say, compared to a percentage of what your current cultural output already is, which has the likelihood of being more of interest to you later on in the game. I don't know. I do like the idea of great philosopher and tying it to a social policy, except that if they're going to be there and allow us to rush a social policy, then kind of a domino effect. Maybe we need to be looking at going back again over what some great, what some social philosophy, social philosophy, what is up with that? Social policies. Social policies give us. I mean, wouldn't that be great? What's the? I know this is a bit of a failure. Trying to remember. What's the one on the? Is it the tradition branch that gives us eventually the two free social policies? No, that doesn't sound right.
No, that's the piety. I think
piety. Thank you. Yes, piety. Wow, piety. That very last branch. Wouldn't that be great to unlock that and then also get, you know, a great philosopher? I mean, you could say, well, hey, that's a strategy that you're going towards.
What might be an interesting idea is play a little bit of with chance with it, you know, like have it so that you can pop your great philosopher for an instant social policy, but you don't get to pick it. It's going to be one of the ones that you're able to take, including opening up brand new trees. So you get the effect of having a brand new social policy instantly, dirt cheap, but you don't get to pick it. So it's sort of a dice roll on whether or not it's going to give you exactly what you want, or it might help influence your strategy. It's like, oh, he opened up the commerce branch. Well, I might as well start going down that tree now.
Hey, this is true. I mean, it could turn out to be another trick that you could do, like, you know, putting research into the tech that you don't want. I don't know if that's great, realism-wise. Also, I was just laughing at the typo. I think he said, they could go inside a city-state's borders and make it an ally, but you put an ally as one word. Anyway.
This is a family-friendly show, Lisa.
I am making it family-friendly. I just alluded to it. I didn't even say it.
We're for all ages now, I see.
It's family-friendly education. Is that what this is?
Oh. Well, I don't think you should have to be able to have great philosophers before you discover philosophy.
It would just be kind of a pain because, you know, that's what I do very well. So I guess we shouldn't have a great artist before we achieve technology X.
Or scientist.
Engineer.
I don't know. It makes sense.
Engineers before engineering? No way.
Merchants before commerce?
Could certainly be done.
Whoa, this is a whole new tactic. So... maybe no great merchants before. Let's see what tech would be tied to. Boss is going crazy now. Currency, great engineer for engineering. What about a great general, though? No great general before...
You can get them anytime because it's a war game.
No great artist before... I want to say artist, maybe that's new tech.
Military science. There we go. Sorry, I had to say it just for fun.
Imagine suggested for a great person. A great person with a landmark ability that generates happiness. So I then assumed that that would consume the great philosopher, just like... So I can't remember the specifics. So dear, like some of the other great people you can use for a particular tile, and you get some particular benefit on that tile that relates to their particular specialty. I could see that as being one option. So you could have that, and then you could also use it to, you know, contribute to some social policy acquisition. I mean, there is, for instance, like with the great scientists, for instance, you get that later on in the game, you use that... maybe not the great scientist, no. But the better example is great engineer. You use that to rush, say, the construction of a wonder. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's now, oh, instant next turn, you're going to get that. I mean, yeah, sometimes that happens, but sometimes it doesn't. So you could have that scale. So somehow it's helping you rush towards a particular social policy that you're trying to get. So we could be all inclusive to these suggestions here.
Could also use a great philosopher maybe to, you know, if you pop them and... the number of cities your empire actually has for purposes of determining how much you need for your next social policy drops by one. So you might have a 6-city empire, but you only need enough culture as if you had a 5-city empire.
Oh gosh, can I play Polynesia with that combination? It's okay. Every single time, woo! I swear. I'm just the evil is wheels of evil. That's not a very good name. I'll think of a better one. But the concept that, all these things in combination, how could I... I'm not going to use the word exploit. How can I take advantage of that combination?
Leverage that.
Ooh, leverage. Even better, even better. Immediate predecessor to Civilization V, Civilization IV, and in so doing, we will have a look at some Civ IV strategy. Awesome.
Yes, industrial parks. Do you ever build them? So this was a topic by Rorezco, something like that, sorry. Great person points for the great engineer if you're looking for mining ink or creative constructions. And the last thing, though, is always the opportunity cost. Because the industrial park does cost 200 hammers, so it takes a while to pay off. If the game is going to end in less than 50 turns, well, it's not really worth building.
Is that... I could see it taking longer than that to pay itself off if you're comparing it against building wealth and you're trying to gun a space race.
Well, exactly, because you lose 4 food for 4 hammers, so you don't really gain anything, in theory.
That depends whether your health capped. A lot of empire setups, can maybe get away with it. So like, say you're running environmentalism for some reason. I actually run environmentalism with decent frequency in cases where I'm heavily cottaged, or, you know, I'm not relying on state property workshops, or something like that, where, yeah, you can use the UN to force AI who are relying on such things into environmentalism and screw them over. Or if, you know, you don't have strong corporations, it's not going to cost you a lot of maintenance, then you might have some health wiggle room. And there's also some special cases, like you're expansive, or you're Japan, so you can trade away your coal and get away with it, things like that, or in your national park city. It has some considerations where you're not health capped, but even there, it's still an expensive building. I guess like anything else in the game, if you really want, you can do the math to see how long it'll take to pay back its investment with all the constraints. That's not something that most people do when they're playing. Certainly, it's not something that I do a lot when I'm playing.
That's true. It comes back to what you really need. If you're just playing for fun, just build it. It doesn't really matter. But if trying for a space race and time is important, well, check the numbers.
Yes.
it's just that it's counterintuitive, because the type of cities where you want to run a lot of specialists, be them engineers or otherwise, or ones that typically have lots of extra food, but the ones that you're going to be wanting engineers in, you're generally going to be looking for production anyway. You can get that more efficiently just by mining more tiles and you know, not going quite for quite as much food, which then doesn't give you the excess food to run the engineers that you get from the industrial park. So it's kind of a catch-22 building.
The exception is if you are running massive food corporations, like you have a strong sushi, so you can get over pop 20 and somehow not run into health issues, or your sushi is just so strong that the health issues don't matter. I mean, that can happen. I've heard of it happening.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe you are in Japan or something, and you know, you have the shale plants, which run without needing coal, essentially, and you can get away with trading your coal away, then you'll need to worry about the oil unhappiness, or you know, maybe you'll need the oil, depending on the situation. And then you can avoid a lot of the unhealthy benefits and maybe even use it in alongside workshops at those higher pop cities. It's not something I would say happens very often. I can't say that I build it too often in most cities, but I can see it in a couple. And someone pointed out in the thread, let me see who it was, Bobby Boy 29, that he builds it in his national park city lot, which, you know, that's almost never health capped anyway. And it has its access to coal removed regardless. So I think, ironically, it's actually less of a health hit there than most places, which is interesting.
And since the national park gives you so many specialists to begin with in that city, you can build up all of your specialist great person point multipliers in there and then throw a couple of engineers on top of it.
Yeah, my only gripe with using it for great person points is it's so late. Yeah, you can't build it until industrialism. Like, even if you're trying to farm a engineer for mining ink, more typical strategies for that, at least as far as I was aware, was using the factory slots or maybe even the ironwork slots to get a great engineer, or just, you know, maybe a wonder or two, or running a forge engineer for a long time and hoping you get one and planning it out that way, as opposed to waiting until industrialism to set up mining ink. It's a lot of those guys who run space wins in the Hall of Fame and get their, you know, deity space win at 1500 some AD or whatever, will rely on a very strong mining ink as well as abusing Marathon. And they try to get to Railroad as soon as possible and set up their ridiculous mining ink. So I think it just depends. It's not a totally useless building, but it's probably not something you're going to see a lot on a game-to-game basis.
Unless perhaps you're an advanced start. Polycast historians, please forgive me for using advanced starts as
an art. Advanced late-era start, because you can have advanced starts or not advanced starts, or any era start that may or may not be advanced.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
So, which of us have each element of the planet? I call not heart, by the way.
I'm going to go with fire. I've got red hair. Come on.
I see.
I don't remember them. There was, like, water and
water,
air. That's
all four.
Earth, fire, wind, water, heart.
Yeah, I call not heart. And I like how Dan picked the one character that was American. That's interesting as well.
What? They weren't American?
They were from all over the world.
They were all over the world. Yeah, you had Wheeler, who was from North America, and he had fire. And then there was the person who had the power from Earth was from Africa. Heart was from Asia. I think Wind was from the USSR, right? And then the water was from somewhere else on the planet. And hate mail. but do you know what the real question is, though? Even if we all agree on what our individual powers are, what happens when we combine those powers? What does that do? Who do we summon?
I think we summon Catherine of Russia, possibly. Slappy-slap diplomacy on other AI.
Safar Safar.
So there's your cultural reference for the day. watch there be a sudden spike in traffic on Wikipedia to find out about Captain Planet.
I just remember watching that show.
Not one person thought we would talk about Captain Planet on this show today. Not even one.
Yes, who knew? A discussion of unhappiness and unhealthiness, or health and happiness, however you want to look at it, leads to a discussion of Captain Planet and the Planeteers. Only on Polycast. This is the value and the ingenuity and the creativity that our audience has come to know and love.
Next on the research lab, the Captain Planet unit. Can he defeat the giant death robot?
I think so, because Captain Planet has all the Earth's elements combined, and so then he'd just be able to strike the giant robot.
So they're like a giant, like, environmental Voltron?
That's because the giant death robot is all mechanical, right? He strikes the giant death robot, and then it just loses all molecular cohesiveness. Yes, I said molecular cohesiveness.
I don't think he works that way. I could be wrong, though.
Yeah, yes, you are wrong. I brought up Captain Planet, so this is my game. We're playing by my rules, and I can change them any time I want. So I win.
Did somebody roll some dice?
It was a D20 dice from Dungeons & Dragons that saw it on our individual rolls for this particular. Like whether you get water, or if you're stuck with heart, possibly. Or if Colonel Mustard's suggestion of sticking it with Mackie because she isn't here is a good one.
I agree. Mackie is heart.
Well, thanks everyone for listening to Polycast episode 113. Is there anything significant about the number 113 or 114?
It's the next turn.
Yeah. Turn 113, 114. Oh, turn 115 is 1 AD, see, on normal speed in Civ 4. So there you go. That's the significance. We are almost to 1 AD in Civ 4.
I'm Daniel Quick. The power is yours! The main team.
See you guys later.
Q&L.
Have a good one, guys.
Cawson.
See ya.
And Pinstar.
Doodles, peeps.
This is a terrible analogy, but it sounded better in my head. But no, you. Immediately.
I feel like.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, you just cut out for a little bit there, or maybe it was just me.
No, it wasn't just you.
I just tried to build all the time. Go on. It's not doing it anymore, so.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Where did I get cut off?
Pretty much in the middle of your sentence there, like, probably...
Oh. Okay, now how are you going to make me remember my sentence that I just said? that's okay.
That's a long time.
On a Saturday afternoon? Really? Oh, man. Okay, I think I was saying... Oh! Alright, so, since we did a lot of, again, discussion of the patch last turn, we've looked at a number of...
Did you just say last turn?
Yes, last episode, which is also now called a turn.
We should just start calling them turns and offer no explanation.
So much for your pact of secrecy now that you broadcast it to the whole interwebs.
No, it was a denouncement.
Oh.
Yeah, didn't they get rid of the pact of secrecy?
Yeah, see?
Oh, yeah.
Get with the times, man.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
That was like two patches ago, Dan.
Oh, jeez. I was wondering if I...
Captain Planet has something to say to you, Dan.
Oops.
I'll think of a witty response later and insert it in post-production.
So cheap.
I know. At least Captain Planet will talk to me. There we go.
That doesn't make sense.
That's his power.
Polycast, when do things have to make sense? Come on, Phil.
Oh, yeah. My bad.
You're trying to apply logic to this show? Fail.
Forgot this is the internet. Just for a moment. I apologize.
We're playing AI logic.
What we're going to try to do is recreate Mount Rushmore and see if recognizes it.
What the hell?
Pardon that in the background there. That was unintentional.
So, like, out of nowhere. Not that I mind. I mean, much of my
time. Today's non sequitur.
Segue here into what I'm thinking of. Speaking of abuse, if you would like to call into the show.
Why?
Oh, come on. Look at Earth. You can be Earth.
I want to be Earth.
No, I get to be her.
Record date March 5th, 2011. Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.